Turn to Judges chapter 4. We're going to try to trek through chapter 8, but I don't know if we're going to make it. We'll see what happens. I don't want to rush through some of these passages. Now, chapter 4 and 5, however, are really describing the very same event in the next oppression of Israel. We've already looked at three judges, Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. And Othniel and Shamgar had a great role of delivering Israel. Ehud had a kind of a grisly role as he stuck the dagger into the king of Moab's body, and he was so big that the whole dagger went in and fat covered it up, and the guy died, and just kind of a grisly killing there. But he was used to deliver them from the Moabites. But Israel, as is the case, they keep falling back into sin. It goes for a generation. It lasts for a period of time. Shamgar was the last one. They had rest for 80 years after Ehud was put out of the picture. Then Shamgar was raised up. But now Ehud, when he was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt at Harosheth Hagoyim. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron, and for 20 years he harshly oppressed the children of Israel. Now, this next coalition that they're facing is a coalition of Canaanite forces led by Jabin and Sisera. Hazor was once the largest city in the entire nation. It's 9 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. There is an archaeological dig there at the Tell, and you can see some of the things, but it was one of the early archaeological digs, and as it was such, it really wasn't done very well, so there's not a whole lot to see up there. Some of the newer sites, they've really perfected it with computers to regenerate everything as it was, but in the early archaeological digs, things were moved around, and they really don't know a whole lot. But Hazor, if you remember Joshua actually destroyed Hazor and killed Jabin. Now, obviously, it's not the same Jabin. It was more oftentimes their names were titles that were carried on when a person was restored. But the city was burned at one point. Now, you can't get any more destroyed than that. And why would Naphtali, in whose territory it is, allow it to be resurrected? Makes you wonder. It makes you wonder about things that, as Christians, the things you overcome in your life. You think, hey, they're gone. I've got this under control. This is, man, I've just totally delivered from this problem. And it's burned with fire as far as I'm concerned. But don't underestimate it. It can easily come back. It can easily slip back in. You never underestimate the power of sin, and they should have never underestimated the Canaanites. And now, not just the fact that Hazor was strong, Hazor is ruling the area, and 900 chariots to boot. Well, it says Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. Now, this should strike you. The Lord did not design for the women to be fulfilling the role of the judges, and yet here is a woman that God has called. She is a prophetess. She's not taken it upon herself. She's certainly called of God to fulfill that role. Now, that should clue you into something. You wonder, and in fact, you do look a little more closely, and the women have a large role in the book of Judges. And you have to wonder why. Where were the men? Why were they not responding to the call? You know, I've seen oftentimes in the mission field that there are predominantly women that are over there serving and doing things that you think, well, where are the men? Well, why aren't they getting involved in this? And you wonder what's going on. Well, here Israel was in this state. It's really a sign of weakness of men here. When God has to begin finding faithful women, and says, okay, well, you cover the base. When she calls herself later in chapter 5, I, Deborah, a mother in Israel, you know, a wife and a mother, you know, that's where my heart was, and yet God called me to this charge. And indeed, God did call Deborah. She was an incredible woman. She would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. But as her place in giving them wisdom was there, she really did not lead the armies, and so she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh and Naphtali, and said to him, Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, saying, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor, take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun, and against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I'll deliver him into your hand. Now, I love this territory in Israel, there in the plain of Jezreel with Tabor, which just stands as a mound. You can see it from all over because it's by itself. It's this nice flat land, and all of a sudden this little hill comes up, big hill actually, Mount Tabor. On it, the traditional site of the Transfiguration, but that wouldn't have been because Jesus was up farther to the north when that happened. But it's easier for tourists to get there, so some of the tour buses take the tourists up there and say this was the place where Jesus was transfigured, and some of the crazy tourists, you know, or leaders will say this is the very spot. You see the footprint here, you know, or whatever, and it's kind of silly. But it is a beautiful area. In a very notable area, and when you're there, a lot of these battles, you when you read again some of these things, you go, oh, I can picture that, and it's kind of exciting as a picture. But God is challenging, or Deborah's challenging Barak to go and deploy troops, take care of business here. Well, Barak said to her, now this is really indicative of the men at that time, well, if you go with me, then I'll go, but if you will not go with me, then I won't go. That was pretty weak. And, of course, how does she respond? She said, I'll go with you, but nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you're taking, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. He went up with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with him. And Heber the Kenite, the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites, and pitched his tent near the terebinth tree at Zanaim, which was beside Kadesh. Now, later Israel was called to deal with the Canaanites, but Heber, the Canaanite of the children of Hobab, who was connected with Israel in some place. Now, this is important here, because later this family comes into the picture. That they weren't connected with the bad guys, they were connected with Israel, though they were friendly with Jabin. And they reported to Sisera that Barak the son of Abiram had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day the Lord has delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not the Lord gone out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. Now, to picture that, you would have the straight valleys right below, the river Kishon around the area, and in this particular time, it was probably pretty firm ground because Sisera wouldn't have been so stupid to bring out the chariots in the spring season or the rainy season because they would get stuck in the mud and the river would overflow its banks and chariots would be worthless. So it must have been at a time where Sisera had no concern about the weather. And of course, since the Canaanite god was the god of the storms, in his mind, he had nothing to worry about. His god was controlling the weather. So he had it wired. He could handle it. And now Israel's coming down off the mountain. Their protection, of course, up in the mountain, you can't take chariots, so they're protected as long as they're up there. But now they're coming down by faith to fight against these awesome-looking chariots with nothing other than the promise of the Lord. Say, Lord, you got to help us or we're toast. And so they do it. Well, notice what happens. He went down, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak, and Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. Now, we don't know how the Lord routed them until we get to the next chapter, so I'll wait till we get to the next chapter, then you'll know how amazingly the Lord did it. Oh, well, the heck, we'll tell you right now. I can't wait myself. Actually, what took place, we'll find it actually when we get there, but what the Lord had done was there was a downpour. There was the weather, the storms came up, and basically all the chariots got stuck in the mud. They were absolutely worthless. And I think it was ironic that what Sisera was trusting in, his storm god, God used a storm to overcome them, which just showed that he was victorious over their gods. The Lord likes to do those things. I see God's sense of humor all the way through the Old Testament. When you see those little stories, you go, oh, Lord, you're too much. But I can just picture him, you know, saying to his angels, watch this, you know, he worships the storm god, Baal. We'll take care of that matter. And he throws this storm unexpected onto Sisera. And Sisera must have realized, oh boy, I'm in trouble. So he's running, but there's not a man left. However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. So he thought, you know, he would get into this place where he'd be safe. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me. Do not fear. When she had turned aside with her, when he had turned aside with her to the tent, she covered him with a blanket. And he said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty. So she opened a jug of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. Now, if he was thirsty and hungry, this would have had kind of especially if he was tired, this would have put him to sleep. This would have given him low blood sugar at this point, and probably would have nodded out, got very tired. And so she basically puts him to sleep with it. And he said, stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and says, is there any man here, you shall say no. Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg, took a hammer in her hand, and went softly into him and drove the peg into his temple, and it went down to the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary. So he died. Pretty grisly. Judges is like that. Believe me, it gets worse, unfortunately. But you know what? Here is something that's a couple of problems here. Number one, in the East, the law of hospitality is a very strong law. In fact, if someone wants to kill you, even today, and you go into the house of someone that actually wants to kill you, while you're in his house, he can't kill you. It's so strong, hospitality. He has to wait till you go out of his house, and he has to feed you and let you stay the night and take care of you, because it's written in the code. And then after you leave, he'll kill you, you know. But as long as you're in the house, you're protected. You're under the protection. The law of hospitality is very strong. So this is very unusual. The only thing that I can see coming up here was the fact that since he was a Canaanite and a 20-year oppression, and plus the fact that he was not aware that he didn't know the Israeli connection there. He didn't know about Moses' father-in-law and the connection there, that she was very loyal to Israel and she took it personal that he had oppressed them for 20 years. She really got him. You know, she plotted this and she got him and it worked. And God dealt with him. And in fact, it was simply just a fulfillment of prophecy. Deborah said, you won't get the glory, Barak, because God will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. And it's exactly what happened. Of course, it's also fitting, the tent peg and the hammer, because in the East, in that culture, it was the women's job to set up the tent. So she would have been very familiar with those tools. It wasn't like you can see her grabbing this tent peg. Oh, what do I do with this? You know, with the fingernails, I don't know how to handle it type of thing. She knew how to handle her tools. Laid it right into them. But the thing that I find very fascinating is the next verse. As Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, come, I'll show you the man whom you seek. And when he went into her tent, there lay Sisera dead with the peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. So this was a major battle here over Sisera. But it doesn't say much of the response. Now, Barak knew that he wasn't going to get any glory. He knew that somehow the woman was going to get a glory. And there lay Sisera, his enemy, dead at the hands of this woman. And I just kind of imagine, you know, what it must have been like. You know, maybe there was a little conversation between the two of them. He could have said, why didn't you just keep him asleep? Why'd you have to kill him? Why didn't you let me do it? You're going to make me look like a fool. Now I'm going to go out and they're going to say, Barak couldn't do it, had to use a woman to do it. I can just hear the guy saying that now. And I can hear her replying, hey, you know, you got to follow the Lord. You know, I mean, just picture this little dialogue going back and forth. But it would have been a very humbling thing for a general to not get the opportunity. In fact, when you follow through later on, or actually before, one of the kings wanted not to be put to death by a boy because he was embarrassed at that. He says, no, you know, you take care of it. And so one of the kings had to, because of the particular judge didn't have enough, his son didn't have enough guts to put this one guy to death, he had to himself. Now chapter 5 reiterates this whole picture. And Deborah and Barak, the son of Abiram, sang on that day. Now this is actually the first account that took place. Later, chapter 4 would have been actually written later, is the historical account. But the songs and the poetry would have flowed that day as the Lord gave them victory. So here is, in fact, this particular poem is a noted poem among those who study poetry and ancient poetry. This is a very, very well-constructed poem. And as many of the poems in the Hebrew language, it's kind of a climactic parallelism. They don't rhyme words, but they rhyme thoughts. They rhyme ideas. So there's parallel ideas. So I'm going to read through this with just a few comments because it's only recounting the same history so that we can keep the flow of the poetry. Deborah and Barak sang on that day, saying, when leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. Now this illustrates really the problem. There wasn't leaders leading. There wasn't people willing. But when they finally were willing, when the willing few were available, then God blessed them. But the problem even today is the lack of willingness on the parts of people to say, yes, Lord, here am I. I'll be available for you. I'll serve you. I'll do what you want me to do. So often we're coldly calculating. Well, no, what will this cost me if I do this? And well, I'll do this, but I'm not that willing to do this. So the whole song actually unfolds where the people were willing, they were blessed, and she actually points out some of those who were unwilling and they didn't get blessed. But when the people, when the leaders lead. Now, in fairness, your version might read a little bit different because the actual literal line in the Hebrew is not when leaders lead, but it's literally when locks of hair grow long in Israel. That's what it literally saying. And what it actually means is that when people are fully consecrated, the idea when their locks of hair would grow, it was because they were being obedient to the Word of God. So the parallel line there is that when you see that happening, when the locks of hair are growing on the people, and you know they're being obedient, they're consecrating themselves to the Lord, then God will bless. Blessing always follows consecration. When you say, Lord, here's my life, when you, Romans 12, 1 and 2, you present yourself a living sacrifice, then you're going to see the Lord's hand. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. I will sing to the Lord. I will sing praise to the Lord God of Israel. Lord, when you went up from Seir, when you marched through the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens poured. The clouds also poured water. The mountains gushed before the Lord, the Sinai before the Lord God of Israel. Now, the parallel thought here is this is how the victory was obtained. And she's recounting the fact that this downpour, this flood, this poured forth water, the mountains gushing forth, it was the Lord coming forth to fight against Sisera and routed him as such. In the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted. Now she's recounting the problem before. The highways were deserted. Travelers walked on the byways. Why? Well, they were afraid of being accosted by the Canaanites. They couldn't travel on the well-known roads. They had to sneak around because any time they took off traveling, they'd get stopped by soldiers. Village life ceased. It ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. And there's kind of a play on words there. She is a mother and a wife, but at the same time, she was a mother to Israel. And the Lord used her. And verse 8 tells you the problem. They chose new gods. When there was war, then there was war in the gates. Not a shield or spear was seen among the 40,000 in Israel. In other words, they were not willing to fight. They did not even have the resources to fight. They couldn't do anything. And this oppression that they were under, the Canaanites wouldn't even allow them to have any weaponry. So they were basically under control. But this was the problem. They chose new gods. Now we too... John the Apostle, tells us in his last words in his epistle, little children, guard yourselves from idols. Don't think that you're not going to be tempted with idolatry. Now, no, we won't worship the gods the way they worshiped. We won't pull out the little icons and worship them, perhaps. But there are many ways that we can worship idols. Idolatry comes in many forms. And I'm not just talking about the more obvious things. Sometimes those even in ministry can begin worshiping ministry, worshiping the status that it brings them, in the little petty power that they have over their, you know, people that are serving in that capacity. They like that control and they like the people looking up to them. And that subtle thing can come in where you're thinking more of your status and your position than you are truly of serving the Lord. It can happen. You start out with a noble heart, noble mind, but then self comes into the picture and eventually you worship self. Now, ultimately, idolatry will end with the epitome of where all idolatry leads, and that is self-worship. Certainly, we've seen that trend in our country. You know, if you follow the magazines, and you know, it goes from people to us to them to self or whatever. You know, and it gets until me, and it is big selfism. You know, I've never picked up a self magazine. I don't know what's in it, but I can imagine that it's probably filled with things of how you can better yourself and better your body and have body beautiful and have mind beautiful and have lots of friends and. I don't know, but you see the focus? It's self. Ultimately, the Antichrist will be one who will not worship the gods of his fathers, not go after even other gods in the nation, but everything will be revolved around self. Certainly the New Age movement is along those lines. You have, you know, you're truly a god. You must say to yourself, I am God. I am God. And Shirley MacLaine would have us all on tops of mountains, yelling that at the top of our lungs. Because that's her philosophy. And that is certainly going to fit in line with the New Age. Idolatry will come in many forms, and that's the problem. When they chose new gods, then there was war in the gates. And they were absolutely powerless to fight against it. But my heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people. Bless the Lord. Speak, you who ride on white donkeys, which is a picture of those who are in leadership now, who sit in judges' attire and who walk along the road, far from the noise of the archers among the watering places. There they shall recount the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts for his villagers in Israel, and the people of the Lord shall go down to the gates. Instead of being afraid, they'll go right down to the gates of the city. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. Then the survivors came down, the people against the nobles. The Lord came down for me against the mighty. From Ephraim were those whose roots were in Amalek. After you, Benjamin, with your peoples. From Machir, rulers come down. And from Zebulun, those who bear the recruiter's staff. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. So she's commending those who came among them with the nobles. As Issachar, so was Barak sent into the city under his command. And among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. I like that. Before you can really accomplish anything, you have to be resolved to do it. Now, we make New Year resolutions. The idea isn't just to make up something that you'd like to have happen, but not really have any resolve of heart to do it, but to truly make up your mind. Say, this is it. It's time. It's, you know, choose you this day whom you'll serve. It's time to serve the Lord. It's for me and my house. We will. And at that point, there were great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flocks? The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart. Now she's beginning to question those who, although Reuben and Issachar and Naphtali came through, there were some who didn't, who were kicking back. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. They didn't come. They didn't bother. Perhaps there were some connections and they felt with their connections with very close to Moab and the Ammonites that they could not chance that political decision to follow and league themselves. So they remained neutral. And why did Dan remain on ships? Obviously, this is before Dan had moved to the north. He's still down there by the area of the Philistines. But he didn't bother coming. And Asher continued at the seashore and stayed by his inlets. And Zebulun is a people who jeopardized their lives to the point of death. Naphtali also in the heights of the battlefield. So she's commending those who moved and she's rebuking those who stayed. But you know, there will always be those who will be not involved in the war. Not involved in the battle. Who remain neutral. Who are observers. And it's kind of sad because you can be an observer. You can kick back. But there's no reward in that. There's no joy in that. There's no, you know, you're participating from a distance. Now, it's interesting, too, that who knows what kind of political connections they had that made them, they might have been strong reasons why they couldn't get involved in their own mind. You know, there are many excuses that people make about their own lives. Well, I've got to make a living, or I've got to do this, I can't do that, I don't have time. And yet, the bottom line is, we need, as people of God, to make great resolves of heart to say, Lord, here's my life. I want to choose to follow you, to be obedient to you. Not my will, but your will be done. Whatever that might be. Whatever that entails, I'm willing. Not to be afraid of what the Lord might do, because he'll only lead you into victory. You can't lose. When William Carey wanted to go to India, be a missionary and serve the Lord there and reach the peoples who had never heard the gospel, most of his contemporaries advised him against it and said, no, you don't need to go there. If God wanted you to go there, he'd have made you Indian. He'll raise up somebody there. You don't have to worry about that. But there was something in his heart that says, no, I must go. And he went, and God used him incredibly. When all the others stayed back, he had a resolve of heart to go. Well, the kings came and fought. The kings of Canaan fought in Tamak. By the waters of Megiddo, they took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens, and the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. This ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. Oh, my soul, march on in strength. Then the horse's hooves pounded in the galloping of his steeds. So this picture of the rivers taking them by surprise. Now, there's a little sarcasm here in verse 19. Says the kings came, but this time they didn't carry off any silver. This time it was going to be different. Usually when they came, they walked off with some spoils of war. But this time, sorry. Curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord. Curse its inhabitants bitterly because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. Now they didn't do anything wrong. It's what they didn't do that they get cursed for. Most blessed among the women is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Blessed is she among women in tents. He asked for water, she gave milk. She brought him out cream in a lordly bowl. The cream would have been actually curds of milk, which was it's called Leban, and it's highly desired in that country even to this day. She stretched forth her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer. She pounded Sisera. She pierced his head. She split and struck through his temple. Again, notice the parallelism. Notice the strong language. Notice the imagery here. Very strong poem with a lot of imagery. And then the meter here. At her feet he sank. He fell. He lay still. At her feet he sank. He fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. And then a touch of irony. The mother of Sisera looked through the window and cried through the lattice, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarries the clatter of his chariots? Her wisest ladies answered her, yes, she answered herself, are they not finding and dividing the spoil to every man a girl or two? For Sisera, plunder of dyed garments, plunder of garments embroidered and dyed, 2 pieces of dyed embroidery for the neck of the looter. Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord. This is an interesting picture, this irony of how his mother would look at it. And she's imagining in her heart prosperity. She's imagining, oh, things are good. It's going to work out great. The imaginations of the wicked, really, will come to nothing. You know, the desire of the wicked, the Bible says, will perish. What he desires, what he imagines for himself. He's got lots of plans, but apart from God, he has really no hope. Let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. So the land had rest for 40 years. Very touching poem of a touching incident. Children of Israel, however, very quickly, the cycle continues, did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Now we don't know what happened in those 40 years. How long did it take them to finally fall back into idolatry in those 40 years? We don't know. But it slowly came back, and sin is like that. Our life, we should be closely watching over our life and our teaching and what we're living and how we're being. And it was really funny because on the way up here, I got behind somebody slow, and they pulled out in front of me, made me slow way down, and I'm waiting and waiting, and you know, I'm like, I can't believe this, you know. So I've got to be a teacher, right, and teach this person that they're not driving smart. So I get up and I'm tailgating them, and finally they even go slower, and now I'm starting to get into it. And we finally get up the intersection, and I pass them, and I look back, and I go like this to them, you know. And my daughter says, Dad, why don't you practice what you preached this morning? Ooh. But you know, it's true. We can forget how quickly we can get right back into it. And, you know, I'm not a super saint in this area. I learned that I can say one thing and I can still do the wrong thing. So the Lord had to teach me a lesson there through the mouth of my little daughter. And bless her heart. I looked at her and I said, thanks, honey. I needed that. Now shut up, kid. No, I didn't say that. But here's Israel. They've experienced a great deliverance, and now they're back to where they started, under the oppression of the Midianites. Well, the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of the Midianites. The children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which were in the mountains. So whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up. Also, the Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. They'd encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts, both they and their camels without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage. The Lord always does this. He reminds them what he did, how he delivered them. And that's, to me, this is a likening to me going back to the cross. Whenever you find yourself slipping, going out into the left field in your walk with the Lord, you're feeling very dull and of hearing, you're not there, you're starting to stumble in things that you haven't in a long time, it's a good idea to go back to the cross of Jesus. Look closely at what Jesus did for you on the cross. Look at what price he paid to deliver you from sin. Look at what he accomplished for you. And then realize that he wants you to take up your cross and follow him. And come back to the simplicity of that. And I think this is, the Lord always reminds them of bringing them out of bondage of Egypt, that they were a special people. I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all those who oppressed you and drove them out from before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But you've not obeyed my voice. So the very quick message, not much hope in that message. Lord didn't intend hope at that point. He wanted to rebuke them, let them realize why they were suffering, but not give them any way out. But at the same time, behind the scenes, what they don't know right now, the angel of the Lord came and sat under a terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, and which belonged to Joash the Abizarite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." So this picture of this guy, who's an average guy, you know, the fifth son of his family, the youngest and of an insignificant family, here he is threshing in a wine press to hide from the Midianites. And the angel said, "You mighty man of valor, the Lord is with you." I love this paradox. The Lord, how he views people. Well, Gideon said to him, "O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us?" Obviously, he wasn't at the church service when the prophet was telling them why. But where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, "Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." And the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" I wouldn't say this is a trick question. But I would say that there is something here. When the Lord says, "Go in this might of yours," is that not instructive? Is he implying, "Gideon, you don't need my help? Go and you can win the battle." Or is there something there that when he says, "Go, do it," just like God tells us, Jesus says, "Go," but he does add, "I will be with you." Here he says, "Go," and he says, "Have I not sent you?" Though we go and we walk forth with our own bodies and our own minds and our own speech and we're moving forward, we're depending upon the Lord. We're recognizing he is with us. He sent us. So he said to him, "O my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." And the Lord said to him, "Surely I'll be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man." And then he said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me. Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you." And he said, "I'll wait until you come back." And Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread from the ephah of flour, and the meat he put in a basket, put in the broth in a pot. He brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. So basically, this person that's talking with him there in very real form, Gideon is not totally sure this person is really who he's coming off to be. And he wants a little proof, so he's bringing him out, basic Eastern hospitality, giving him a meal. But the angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth." And he did so. And the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. In your versions, it may well be capitalized, angel, and every time he's referring to him as you, there's a capitalization there. It's because this is, again, one of those places where it's believed Jesus is making an appearance. Why? Because he's speaking in first person singular. "I delivered you. I will be with you. I have sent you." So when you see angel, the term is simply messenger. Jesus is the messenger of the covenant. He is both God, but he's also the messenger. What did God say? He saw that there was no man to stand in the gap, and he says, "I will bring forth salvation with my own arm." Even that there's inclinations to it that you can find in secret language, kind of not secret, but little subtle forms. When Abraham gets the ram and catches it in the thicket, he tells Isaac, as Isaac is walking up the hill with the wood for the sacrifice, and Isaac says, "Hey, we've got wood, we've got fire, but there's no sacrifice." And Abraham said, "The Lord will provide himself a sacrifice." And the construction of the words could be put in that form. The Lord will provide himself, literally. And here, the angel of the Lord, the messenger of the covenant, comes and appears to him. And now he is given this incredible sign to Gideon. And of course, Gideon perceived it was the angel of the Lord. And then Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." And the Lord said to him, "Peace with you. Do not fear. You shall not die." So he thought he was going to die. According to tradition, he understood. You see God's face, you die. That's what the word says. No man can see my face and live. His tradition taught him that he couldn't see, but obviously he saw Jesus and lived. That's a good picture for us. So the Lord said to him, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die." So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it the Lord Shalom, the Lord Peace. To this day, it's still in Ophrah of the Abizrites. And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said to him, "Take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it. And build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this rock in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer the sacrifice with the wood of the image which you shall cut down." So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants, but did as the Lord said to him, but because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. Kind of like Nicodemus, who came to Jesus by night. He was a little embarrassed to come by day, so Nick came by night. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down. The wooden image that was beside it was cut down. The second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. So they said to one another, "Who has done this thing?" And when they had inquired, they asked and said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing." And the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal, and because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it." And Joash said to all those who stood against him, "Would you plead for Baal? Would you save him? Let one who would plead for him be put to death by morning. If he's a god, let him plead for himself, because his altar has been torn down." Therefore on that day he called him Jerubbaal, saying, "Let Baal plead against him, because he has torn down the altar." Now what's happening here is there is this irony here where his father, who'd even been in charge of the altar, is sticking up for his son, saying, "Hey, if Baal is God, let him plead for himself." So he actually gave his son a different name, called him Jerubbaal, which actually meant, in kind of a subtle language, that let Baal plead. In other words, in a way, some of the people were now calling him this because they were watching. They were going, "Oh, he's going to get toast, man. We're going to watch him. He's going to die a sudden death. Baal's going to stick up for himself. We believe in Baal. Go, Baal. Give me a B. Give me an A. We'll take care of this guy." And so they called him, you know, kind of like, "We'll watch until Baal destroys you." And that's his name now. "We'll watch until Baal destroys you," type of thing. Funny thing, he kept living. And all the Midianites and the Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together. And they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. So now the people have a greater problem. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet, and the Abizrites gathered behind him. And he sent messengers throughout Manasseh, who gathered behind him. And he also sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. And Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said..." So he's been encouraged to get the people, gather them, and the Spirit of the Lord is upon him, and he's gathered this great army, and then he comes to the standstill. "What do I do now? You know, are you sure, Lord? I want to make sure these..." I mean, think about leadership. It's like that. I mean, you feel God's calling you, move forward, and then you get, you know, a leader, obviously, you've influenced people, and people are following your lead, but now you want to make sure. "I don't want to... This is just me. I'm in big trouble." So now he's looking for a sign. He says, "Look, I'll put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there's dew on the fleece only, and it's dry in the ground, then I'll know that you'll save Israel by my hand, as you have said." It was so. He rose early the next morning, squeezed the fleece together, wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. And Gideon said to God, "Don't be angry with me. But let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry on the fleece, but on all the ground let there be dew." And God did so that night. I love how God accommodated him. It was dry in the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the wall of Herod. So the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord sent to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to save or to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.'" Now this was normally prescribed in the battle. Moses had even given this okay, that when you speak to the troops, you say, "If anybody's afraid, let them go home. You don't have to fight in this war." But it would be a little discouraging if you were a leader and 22,000 of the 30,000 people take off. Only 10,000 remain. You just lost two-thirds. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I'll test them for you there. And then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself, and everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men, and all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, by 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand, and let all the other people go, and every man go to his place. Now, I've seen a lot of commentaries on this that disagree with what's happening. Some feel that there's significance in the way they drank water so as to make them more mighty men, because they didn't just put on their equipment and settle down and, you know, get on their knees. They were wary, and they were looking around, and they reached down and they lapped like a dog, type of a thing. We really don't know. It doesn't say that these men were more special or more mighty and more noble. In fact, the implication here of these 300 men that he says, let all the other people go to his place, but retain these. The idea there is that there was kind of like these 300 men were saying, okay, you want just us 300, but what about those guys? And they were thinking, gee, I don't know if I want to just stay with 300. I want to be with that. This is crazy. And there was an idea that Gideon had to constrain them. Hey, you know, don't worry about it. Stay with me. It wasn't like these were the most mighty men. What happened on the same night? So the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands, and he sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained the 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below them in the valley. So all the provisions, all the various jars that they would have had for food, and all their torches and everything, of the 10,000, they handed over to the 300. So the 300 were loaded down with all these provisions, but they were going to use them more than just food. So it happened on the same night. The Lord said to him, arise and go down the camp, for I've delivered it into your hand. But if you're afraid to go down to the camp with Pur, your servant. You'll hear what they'll say. Afterwards, your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. And he went, and notice, went down with Pur, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. And the Midianites, the Amalekites, all the people of the east, lying there as numerous as locusts, or camels without number, sand as the seashore. And when Gideon had come down, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, I've just had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread, or literally a barley biscuit, a little tiny round thing, tumbled into the camp of Midian, came to a tent and struck it so it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed. And his companion answered and said, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation. I mean, here he's going down to camp, picked a tent out of the 10,000, picked a time out of all the different times he could have went. And there at the right time, he hears this guy say, hey, this dream I had, and hey, that's nothing more than the sword of Gideon. And the Lord has delivered Midian into his hands. Now, I think that that's probably the most spectacular sign of them all, because that was the thing that clinched it for Gideon. When he heard that, he said, all right. That's incredible, Lord. I love how the Lord is intimately acquainted with the details of life and orchestrates so much that we're not even aware of. When he heard it, he worshipped, returned to the camp, and said, arise, the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand. And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. Watch when I come to the edge of the camp, and you'll do just as I do. When I blow the trumpet, and I who are with me, all who are with me, then you shall blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came at the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. Just as they had posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands, and the three companies blew the trumpets, broke the pitchers, which would have exposed the light, And they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." And every man stood in his place all around the camp. And the whole army ran and cried out and fled. And 300 blew the trumpets. The Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp. And the army fled to Beth Achaia toward Zerera, as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabith. And the men of Israel, let's just say it was a long way, the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. Now at this point, all the men gathered. The 300 got the victory, but now they're calling for reinforcements, and all the men of Israel now are coming in and cleaning up the spoil. They're not going to get credit for the victory, but they're going to clean up the spoil because there's so many to clean up. Then Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize them from the watering places as far as Beth Barah and to the Jordan." And all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Beth Barah and Jordan. They captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the Rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. Makes sense. They pursued Midian, brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. What a victory. Unfortunately, when God uses one individual mightily, there is this thing called envy that comes to play. And that's what happens with these guys from Ephraim. I don't like these guys from Ephraim. Most of the time, they're very proud. They think they're hot stuff. And they're always like pushing themselves in front, and this is no exception. The men of Ephraim said to him, "Why have you done this to us and not called us when you went to fight with the Midianites?" And they reprimanded him sharply. You know, like, "Hey, you didn't let us have any of the glory." So he said to them, What have I done now in comparison to with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and what was I able to do in comparison with you?" What a great guy. I mean, he was so humble. He says, "Hey, you guys did more than I did so far." I'm sure he was probably thinking, "You little..." Whatever. "You shouldn't be here anyway." But he was gracious. You know, in a way, I think this is wise. You know, I think when God has used you to do something, you should always look at others around you really as more important than yourself. Never think that you've accomplished something. Look what I have done. Remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar when he stood in out in his balcony and he looked over his town and he said, or his city, and he goes, "Look at this great city that I have built, what I have accomplished." And at that point he turned into a madman because God warned him, "Don't take the glory." Because God is the one that raises up and lowers. But Gideon was humble. He gave him the break. And Gideon then came to the Jordan. Their anger toward him abated when he said that. So he was a shrewd politician. Gideon came to the Jordan, and 300 men who were with him crossed over exhausted but still in pursuit. Oh, you could make a sermon out of this one particular verse. Exhausted but still in pursuit. That, folks, is the key to real victory. You get a little victory sometime and you get a little tired and you think you've got enough. The real key to victory, real victory, is when you're tired and you don't feel like reading your Bible and you don't feel like seeking the Lord. You don't feel especially spiritual, but you still go for it. There's the real secret to victory. There's the real secret to these guys, these 300 men who weren't especially mighty or noble, but they were willing. In fact, when you look at both stories of Deborah and Barak, you look at Gideon, you look at the 300 men, you get this whole theme through here. Willing, few, but willing. Few, but willing. And willingness of the individual, God can use. But I love this. And whenever I get exhausted, I think, well, I still want to go forward. And he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they're exhausted, and I'm pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian." And the leaders of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give bread to your army?" Now they're saying this because if they help Gideon and he fails, they're in deep trouble. But they didn't see God was with them. It may have been a logical It may have been a wise, prudent, political decision that they made not to help Gideon, but they weren't right. You know, you can make a logical decision, you can make a seemingly wise decision, but if the Lord's not in it, it's not going anywhere. Well, the leaders of Zuccah said, "Are they in your hand that we should help you?" And Gideon said, "For this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I'll tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." So he was gracious with Ephraim, but man, I think he had the end of his graciousness right here. He says, "You guys are history." So he went up there from there to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way, and the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. So when he spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, "When I come back in peace, I'll tear down this tower." Now Zebah and Zalmunna were at Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the army of the people of the east, for 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. Gives you an idea of the impact of this victory. The Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in the tents in the east of Noboth and Jogbehah, and he attacked the army while the camp felt secure. I mean, even still, 300 guys going against 15,000. And when Zebah and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them, and he took the two kings of Midian, Zebah and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. And Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle from the ascent of Heres, and he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him, and he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. So he said, "Hey, I want a list of all these leaders in Succoth, these guys who didn't help me." So he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Here's Zebah and Zalmunna, about which you ridiculed me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna now in your hands, that we should give bread to your weary men?' And he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth." I don't know how he did it, but I get the feeling that it was some type of a gauntlet that you send a guy through. The gauntlet. I can just picture this. And these leaders had to go through this gauntlet with all these thorns and briars, but needless to say, they were humbled. But he didn't kill them. And he was gracious in that respect, but he just wanted to make a point. And so he did that, and he says, "These were my brothers, the sons..." Wait a minute. Verse 17. "Then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Then he said to Zebah and Zalmunna, 'What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?' And so they answered, 'As you are, so were they. One resembled a son of a king.' And he said, 'They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I wouldn't kill you.' But he said to Jether, his firstborn, 'Rise and kill them.' But the youth would not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. So Zebah and Zalmunna said, 'Rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength.'" Now this may seem strange to you. Why would they say that? "You kill us instead." Partially because they didn't want to be killed at the hands of a boy. That would have been ultimate humiliation. So Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna, and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. And the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of the Midian." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." So Gideon started out very, very well in his dependence upon the Lord. But then Gideon said to them, "I'd like to make a request of you, that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder." For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, "We'll gladly give them." And they spread out a garment, and each man threw it into the earrings from his plunder. And the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments, pendants, purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, beside the chains that were around their camels' necks. And Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in the city of Ophrah. Now he did this for the purpose of bringing glory to God. An ephod would have been representative of the Lord ruling them. We're now dependent upon the Lord. See, we've got the priestly ephod here. But unfortunately, though Gideon had the right intention, the people failed to get the point. All Israel then played the harlot with it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his house. Remember what happened later on in the history of Israel. The serpent that Moses raised up in the wilderness, this brass serpent, is in storage somewhere at this point. No one knows where it is, but later it will be brought out, and people will begin worshiping it. And the king at that point says, this is nothing but a thing of brass, and breaks it to pieces. Because the people began worshiping that which was a memorial to put the Lord first. Here, the people do the same thing. I can't help but make one comparison here. When God does a work, people tend to want to make a memorial. And the memorial is good in one sense. Brings to remembrance what God has done. But eventually the memorial can very easily turn into a monument. What God has done at Calvary Chapel, the work of God, no question, not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit. Most of the pastors that came out from Costa Mesa were either on drugs or running from the FBI. Or, I mean, so many things. These guys that were totally, one guy was totally whacked out. One guy wanted to kill his family. And I mean, these are the backgrounds of some of the largest churches in America. God has blessed them. It's obvious it was His work. But Calvary Chapel is gone from that place. Not that, you know, there are people who say that it's totally dead. You know, now the new move of God is over here with the laughter, and the new move of God is going to be somewhere else next year type of thing. I have a hard time with that. But there is a danger after a period of time where it's the name Calvary Chapel that means anything. No, it's not. It was the simple dependency upon the Lord that people said, hey, we can't do anything. Lord, help us. We don't know what we're doing. Show us. And that dependency upon Him, He found vessels that He could use and bless. But as soon as we think we're something, and we start memorializing Calvary Chapel and the movement, and eventually that'll turn in just a monument. And the next stage is a mausoleum. Because that seems to be the stages in church history. First, it's a movement of God. Then it turns into a memorial. Then a monument. And then a mausoleum. It becomes dead. And then the Lord has to do a new work. Every denomination, it seems, started out with this great move of God and has moved in that direction until it's just become a dead organization of man. Calvary Chapel will probably do the same. I hope it doesn't. At least in our day, I hope that we can keep simple, waiting on the Lord, dependent upon Him, and not go after worshiping the principles of Calvary Chapel, but let's worship God. So Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. And Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. So he kind of picks up the name as a kind of like chuckles probably as he uses it. Oh yeah, Jerubbaal's going to get me, or Baal's going to get me. And Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine who was in Shechem also bore him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. Now Gideon, now in leadership, puffed up, starts to accumulate wives, which the Bible tells him very clearly that the king should not multiply wives or horses to himself, but he does anyway. And of course, the weakness of the leader comes back and bites him, because Abimelech turns out to be a pretty bad guy. Gideon, the son of Joash, then died at a good old age, was very up, starts to accumulate wives, which the Bible tells him very clearly that the king should not multiply wives or horses to himself, but he does anyway. And of course, the weakness of the leader comes back and bites him, because Abimelech turns out to be a pretty bad guy. Gideon, the son of Joash, then died at a good old age, was very